Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to inspiring women about their successes and their challenges to help us think differently about our own lives. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Phoebe Morgan. Hello and welcome, Phoebe.
Thank you for having me on. It's a real honour to be invited.
Phoebe is a best-selling author of crime fiction and psychological thrillers and is editor and publishing director at HarperCollins, working on crime thrillers, and runs writing workshops and helps youths get into writing by day and writes her own thrillers by night. How exciting is that? Goodness me. Now, how's it been for you in lockdown? Where have you been, Phoebe?
So I've been physically in London. I have just moved house, actually, which was quite an interesting experience during lockdown. I think emotionally it's been quite tough. I'm a very sociable person and I usually work as part of quite a tight team at work. So actually to be isolated has been quite tough for me. Weirdly, I think this last lockdown has been the hardest. I think a lot of people have said that actually. So obviously we're talking in March 2021. So it's the third UK lockdown. And I think because the weather has been worse, and there has been the good vaccine news and it does feel like we're on the home stretch, but it's almost like when you get to the end of a run or something, that this final leg is harder than the initial stages.
That's so true. That's exactly what I've been feeling too. And I think that's how everyone's been feeling. And I think, you know, I'm similar to you. I think if you're a social person, lockdown is great for introverts or people that don't like socialising or going out very much. It's perfect, but it is hard. I was even saying that to my teenagers. It's like a marathon and this, you've just got to keep going and push yourself over that finishing line, haven't you?
Yeah, you have. And I think everyone is doing that. But I really think it depends what kind of person you are. And I think I'm someone that definitely gets their energy from being around others. And I'm not on my own, I'm with my partner. But it's not the same as what I would normally have as quite a busy social life and a busy work life. So that's quite different.
We need it all, don't we? We need it all. But at least you've got your writing and that's probably got you through lockdown. And you've certainly had an exciting time that we're going to come on and talk about. But moving house has been a massive thing. But anything poignant or resolutions? Because obviously anything can happen and you know, life changing. But have you had any major thoughts or breakthroughs or moments that have changed your thinking?
I don't know. I think I'm someone who worries a lot anyway. And so this year, it's sort of like a manifestation of all the worst things that I thought of, you know, like a global pandemic. It's a pretty scary thing to live through. And I know that I'm very lucky and very privileged and I have not been hugely affected, apart from in the ways that I've just been describing. But I do think it puts things into perspective a little bit. And I think, I hope that when we finally come out of this, I will try to keep smaller worries in perspective a little bit and realise that actually, I think like everyone, it makes you take stock of what is important. And I have been trying to go back and see my family as much as, you know, within the government guidelines when you're allowed to, and try and talk to my family and stay close to the people that really matter, and not get so bogged down in the smaller stuff. So it's not revolutionary, but I think it is a real wake-up call in terms of what is the stuff that actually really matters to you now, because, you know, none of us could have predicted this and none of us could have predicted how long it will go on for. I mean, yesterday I was saying to my friend how weird it would have been if we had been told it would be a whole year.
Yes.
This time last March. And actually, I think it's better that we didn't know, that we just kept taking it month by month.
We were told it was going to be 3 weeks and we thought that was bad, didn't we? And no, I totally understand where you're coming from. And I think, yes, we remind ourselves how lucky we are, but I don't think any of us should invalidate what we are feeling, because it is okay to feel some horrible days or some not so great days or whatever, and just think, how are we going to get through that? And you know, it's been tough for everybody, whatever have got or haven't got. So do you think there is a book in all of us, in terms of we've had that time, we've been reflecting, and how do we begin to find it and draw it out of ourselves? Do yours just come to you, or, you know, what do we have to have three in our heads?
I think that everyone who wants to have a book in them can. I think a lot of it is about persistence, and I think writing can be romanticized quite a lot. So a lot of people potentially think they have to be in the right place and the right time, and they have to have the perfect setting in order to be able to sit down and write. But I think actually it works for me to treat it a bit more like a job, and I suppose when you're published and you're in contract, it is a job. But the most important advice I would give is that you have to sit down and get the words on the page. And there's no point talking about writing a book or thinking about writing it. You actually have to write it. And I think the difference between people that end up being published and the ones that don't is just that persistence. And obviously it's about having the ideas. I wouldn't say, I don't feel like I'm a person that's full of ideas, especially not at the moment. I feel quite creatively stifled. But I do think that, you know, you can start with a gem of an idea and you could start with a setting. I quite often start with a setting or a character and then take it from there and just let your imagination run free in that sense. And you might find that you start to develop a story as you go along. So I think it's sometimes taking that leap of faith. And I think a lot of people, they either get daunted by the blank page, like the starting point of the book, or they reach about 20,000-30,000 words and then they stop at that point in the novel. And the key is to just push on, I think, and don't beat yourself up if you're finding it hard, because all writers find it hard. I mean, I work with a huge amount of writers in my career, you know, I've worked with a lot of different people, and none of them have ever said to me, oh, this book was the easiest thing I've ever written. Everybody struggles with it at various stages. And then even when you get published, there's other struggles because you're giving over your work to someone else and that's not within your control. So that's really difficult in some ways as well. So I think to be a writer, you have to build up a kind of a level of resilience, which probably this year has taught a lot of us to be more resilient.
So literally, I mean, you must get loads of submissions from wannabe authors and you think about the hook, don't you? And at the moment, is it down to what's going on in the world or what people are feeling or fashions? You know, what are the seasons or the best time for people to pitch?
Well, so I only take submissions from literary agents at the moment. So I do get quite a lot of submissions, but agents will get even more. They will be absolutely inundated. I was talking to one this morning and she said she's getting about 100 a week at the moment. I mean, I wouldn't get anywhere near that as an editor. It would be much smaller number. But I think we always try and predict the trends in publishing. We always try and look for the next big thing. And as a crime editor, we're always watching the charts, we're seeing what's in the top 10, and we're trying to predict what might be there next week. And so we are aware of the market. And I think for writers, it's worth having that awareness as well. I don't think it's a bad thing if it's something that interests you. But ultimately, we don't have crystal balls. And sometimes there'll be a big hit that comes out of nowhere and people won't have seen it coming and it'll be a runaway success. And then there'll be a kind of slew of copycat publishing. So it's not always predictable. And in terms of timing, traditionally, there's the London Book Fair and the Frankfurt Book Fair every year. Obviously, this last year, things have been a bit different. A lot of the book fairs have gone online. And this year, the London one has moved back a few months, I think, to June. So some people submit around those. But realistically, you can submit to agents all year round. You just have to check their websites and check their what they want and what their guidelines are. But usually it can be all year round unless they specifically say that they're closed. Yes. At the moment, there's quite a lot of submissions. It feels like things have ramped up in the last few weeks, especially on the crime front. It was quite quiet in sort of December, early January. I think people were probably just exhausted.
My goodness me. And we're missing bookshops. I mean, I love books, but when I was last in a bookshop, they wouldn't allow me to touch it. And, you know, I always look at the back of a book and I always read the first page. And they said, you can only do that if you're going to buy it. And that frustration. But presumably Kindle sales are up and, you know, the world has pivoted, hasn't it, in terms of, are we reading more or we're all sort of zoning out, watching, binging on TV and podcasts instead?
Well, I think it's a balance. I think people are reading more. All the surveys we've done at HarperCollins does show that fiction sales are up, which is obviously brilliant news. I think people are buying a lot online. Amazon already had a huge market share, but their market share has become even bigger in the last year, 2021. I think people are turning to audiobooks quite a lot. So audio sales are up, but you know, print sales are strong as well. People are still buying those hardbacks and paperbacks. I think it's just that they are buying them online rather than going in and browsing. And at the moment, you know, the high street has been shut down for a couple of months now. So it's quite a difficult point for Waterstones and for the independents, but hopefully if they get to open again, that will be a real turning point. And I hope that people will go back into a bookshop and browse.
Yes, it's that impulse, isn't it? Because people are buying, I mean, I'm buying lots of books to read when I get around to it, but I think that impulse has gone, hasn't it? And you talk about charts, and I know in some of your blogs before you've said, you know, look at the Sunday Times bestsellers chart, because basically they have the hook or the summary as a one-liner next to the novel, don't they? And obviously, Richard and Judy recommend. Are people very influenced by the charts and, you know, what other people say they should be reading?
I think at the moment, particularly they are. It's actually interesting that you bring that up, because I was looking at the top 20 last week and they were all either big brands, by which I mean people like JoJo Moyes, Ian Rankin, you know, these kind of huge names that are household names that have kind of transcended the book buying audience into just the general population. So they were either big brands or they were Richard and Judy picks. So I think at the moment, because the world feels so uncertain, readers are drawn to things that they know, so they don't want to take any risks, and it's quite a risk-averse market at the moment. And I'm hoping that when lockdown eases, people will have more of an appetite for new voices and debuts, because a lot of the books I work on are new authors who've only been published once or twice and with building their careers.
Yes.
So I hope that people will turn to those more as well. But in a nutshell, I think, yeah, people are influenced by what they see is doing well. And word of mouth is massive as well. You know, if you see someone recommending something online or talking about it and you get that buzz, that's always what we're trying to achieve.
Definitely. And I was looking actually at the charts this week, and it had, you know, across the genres, it had philosophy, it had women's books because of International Women's Day this week, it had books about hope, about climate solutions, very sort of practical family. I couldn't see any crime actually in the top 10, so it was interesting. And assumably, you know, and we'll come on to talk about your books, that covers true crime and, you know, fictitious crime, but incredible. So if we just touch on characters, I know when you're looking for plots, you want the plots to feel quite layered. I mean, how do people begin to plot a book? Is it post-it notes on the wall, or as you say, start with a character? How do they think in that multi-dimensional way? It just seems so mind-blowing.
I think people have different techniques, and I think the one thing I would say is that there isn't a one-size-fits-all technique. So some of my authors do the post-it note route, and you know, they'll have these amazing whiteboards with everything plotted out. Some people use Excel documents and they plot it all out like that, but some people just write. I mean, a lot of the authors I know will literally just sit down and start with an idea and see where it takes them, and I do that quite a lot as well, and then I go back and I edit it, and so it might be that a plot point changes as you go on, or it comes to you later and then you revise it slightly, so that not everyone has it plotted out from start to finish. I think it's a good idea to know this sort of general direction of where you want to go and the tone of the novel. I usually have a sense of how I want the book to end, so I sort of have the beginning and I have the ending and I have the characters and the setting, and I don't always have the middle plotted out, and I think that's probably quite common. But I think it really depends on what sort of person you are, because I find the idea of sitting down with an Excel document a bit overwhelming, and I think it reminds me of being at school or doing maths or something hideous like that, and so actually that kind of stops me in my tracks. And I think for some people it helps them and for some it doesn't, so you've got to do what's best for you.
Yes, of course. And brilliant. And we're going to come on to talk about that, actually, because you're a proud author yourself of 4 books, which is amazing that you've done all of that already. And where does your inspiration and drive come from?
So my first book was published, I think, when I was 27. It was called The Dollhouse. So that was about 4 years ago, as you said. And then I've had a book a year since then. And I think originally I really wanted to be published. In my mid-20s, I just felt, I think it was something I'd always wanted, and I hadn't really acknowledged it to myself properly, because when I was at school and university, they didn't really say that writing was a career option. They didn't even really say publishing was a career option. So I originally trained to be a journalist because I thought I like working with words, and that seemed like the only route, either that or an English teacher, and I knew I didn't want to teach. So I think there needs to be more awareness in the kind of younger generations that actually writing and publishing, you know, they are routes that you can try. So yeah, I didn't really start properly thinking about it until I was probably in my mid-20s. And then I started writing The Dollhouse, and I sent it out to quite a lot of agents, and then eventually secured my agent and then a publishing deal. And it sort of continued since then. And each book, I used to write more about what I knew. So my first book was about some siblings and their relationship with their father and a dollhouse he had built them. So it was a little bit more close to home in terms of what my own family situation was like. It's not based on my family, but there were sort of influences. And then my second book was set in the village where I used to live. So I kind of kept it quite local. And then with my latest book, which is coming out in a month's time, it's set in Botswana. So very different. It feels like a very different book to me. And actually, I think it's the one I've enjoyed writing the most. It's been a lot of fun to do something that feels a bit bigger and it feels a bit different. So that's been a sort of trajectory. I think as you get older and you write more, you're more willing to take risks. Whereas for my first couple of books, I felt as though I wanted to keep them kind of quite neat. I wanted them to fit in these neat little boxes. And then this last one has been a bit different.
Amazing, amazing. And so young, you know, that you started with all of that. And as you say, the first book made people look at dolls' houses sort of eerily differently. I read when that came out in 2017, deliciously creepy, genuinely unnerving and incredibly confident was one of your reviews. Your second book, The Girl Next Door, was in 2019, described as a gripping psychological thriller. And that was about dark secrets, wasn't it? Hidden by the wife from her husband and a murder. I mean, how do you begin to even research shocking details?
So The Girl Next Door is probably my second favourite of the ones I've written. And I did talk to a few people. So I spoke to someone who was an anger management specialist because that was the theme of the book. So I did have a phone call with him. He was really helpful and interesting. And I spoke to someone who used to be a police officer to try and get some of the details right about the murder. Yeah, so that one did require quite a lot of research. I'm not someone who feels as though they have to get every single thing accurate, because I think sometimes, you know, when I worked in journalism, I was a court reporter for part of it. And if you sit in an actual courtroom and watch, you know, the proceedings, it is incredibly slow and boring. So I think in art or in fiction, you have to be able to have a creative license and you have to be able to, you know, speed things up a little bit for the reader, and you can't follow the exact way a police operation would go because it would just take up, you know, the book would be way too long.
But some of it's very dark, isn't it? I mean, The Babysitter, thriller set in Suffolk, obviously where you grew up and where I live actually in Suffolk, it's again about murder. I mean, very dark with twists and turns and people on the edge of their seat. Do you have sleepless nights with reading, you know, not only writing your own, but reading scripts that are sent to you? These are very dark stories, aren't they?
It's going to make me sound a bit of a psychopath when I say no, but I think because I read so much crime and I'm very immersed in it that they don't really, because I am quite aware that it's fiction. I watch quite a lot of crime dramas as well, which is strange because I am quite a jumpy person. Like, I wouldn't love to be on my own in the house at night and stuff. Like, I can be quite jumpy, but I think because it's my job, I really compartmentalize it, and I really treat it as a job, and I treat it as fiction and something to be worked on, and I kind of don't let it invade my own head that much. And I think because of the volume as well, the volume of reading in my job is very high, so I'm always reading a new manuscript or several new manuscripts, and then I'm working on my own books as well. So there's almost not time for one story to get too deep because you're almost onto the next one already.
And you're looking for something specific as well, aren't you, in terms of, you know, the process, or maybe it's the process of the solving and the that interests you. It's incredible. And true crime, do you get sent true crime as well?
I have fictionalized versions of true crime. So I'll publish books where the author has been inspired by a true crime. I don't publish straightforward true crime because that would class as non-fiction, but I do publish, you know, novels that have been inspired by true crime. And that's really interesting. And I think that market is growing as well.
It is. I mean, it's huge in podcasting, obviously, with the success of Serial in America and you know, the trial reoccurring. But people have a passion for crime, particularly in the UK, don't they? And predominantly women, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, well, the fiction book buying audience is predominantly women. So we're often thinking about who our audience is, who our reader is, and often it is a woman. And I think definitely in terms of podcasts and audio, true crime is massive. I've actually just signed someone up, I can't say yet, but she's a true crime podcaster and she's going to write us a book. And that feels really exciting because she does so much research into her cases. And so she can kind of bring all that forensic detail into her novel. So definitely there's a massive market there, I think. And it's also quite big in America and the UK, I think.
And are any of yours going to be made into a film like The Girl on Train and things like that? Because I think I actually do enjoy psychological thrillers, probably on TV even more so than books. And, you know, are you going to take that leap with any of yours?
I mean, I would love to, Nikki, but you have to wait for someone to come knocking.
We can door knock, see if anyone listens to this podcast and reaches out. We'll share the profits on that one. So your exciting new book that launches in April, I mean, brilliant timing for you, because just as you launch it, the whole bookshops open up and you can presumably do some sort of social distance appearance in some way with your book tour.
I don't know. I've got a few events booked in, but they're all online at the moment because I think people are just not sure yet whether things will be able to go ahead in person, which is a shame. Like I love doing events online in person. I love like in real life festivals and talks, and I really hope all that comes back. But at the moment, people are being quite cautious.
That's understandable. But this one has a different spin. It's you got an American deal that came in lockdown. I mean, amazingly. And it was set in Botswana. Did you ever go to Botswana?
No, I would love to. And I actually was thinking of going, but then the lockdown happened and then obviously I couldn't. So I did quite a lot of research. I watched quite a lot of videos of people on safari. I had to watch this weird video that someone had filmed of them walking through the airport and coming out of the airport just so I could describe that experience properly, and did a lot of reading around it. The book is called The Wild Girls and it's set in a safari lodge, a luxury safari lodge in Botswana. And I found this amazing website that had all these beautiful photos of these lodges. They're absolutely stunning. I keep showing it to everyone. I'm obsessed by it. So I would love to go one day, but I've not been able to yet.
You'll be able to go with your book under your arm proudly. So it's three estranged friends who have a reunion set off for an all expenses paid trip to Botswana. There's surprises, lies, secrets, obsession, revenge that happens under the African sun. So if you've got a copy of your lovely book, I was going to ask you to please read a snippet on, as you describe, when the girls arrived in Botswana, as that humid, warm air hits them. Everyone always remembers that exhilarating feeling, don't they, as they get off a plane. So here we are, arriving in Botswana. I believe it's page 68 of your new exciting book.
The heat hits me as soon as I step off the plane. It feels thick, like a heavy blanket, and utterly all-encompassing, filling my mouth and drying my eyes so that they feel gritty and small. The sky is inky black. It's late here now. We're 1 hour ahead of London. And above us, the stars glow silver, little jewels in the dark. It feels otherworldly and totally magical. I felt groggy when I woke up, as though I'd been hit on the head or something. But now, excitement pulses through me like a hot rod down my spine. And actually, I'm grateful that I was able to sleep the whole way, all 11 hours, and that I didn't get sick. That would have been embarrassing, to be honest. Hannah says there was a bit of turbulence, which I'd have absolutely hated. I'm such a baby about things like that.
Lovely. Thank you. Exciting and intriguing, your new book. So you were thinking Christmas was cancelled in 2020, and you get a call from your agent, and you were sitting in the bath, I believe.
So my agent, she called me, and she said that we had interest in The Wild Girls in America, which was really exciting because we have had my first three books out on submission in the US, and they have never sold. So I kind of resigned myself to the fact that I would never sell in America, because it is quite difficult. I know that it's quite a tough market to crack. Anyway, so she rang me and she said we have this US interest. And I was so surprised. I couldn't believe it. And then she said, you know, there was a couple of things that it wasn't a firm deal yet. There was a couple of things going on. And so she said that we had to wait until January. So we had to have like the Christmas break in between. And obviously it wasn't a proper break, like you said. It was a kind of horrible situation. So, you know, Christmas had just been cancelled and I ended up spending it in London with my partner, which was lovely, the two of us, but I had wanted to go see my family. And then in January, she rang me back and she said that we had the deal, which was just so exciting because it just meant a lot to me because I had really told myself that it wouldn't happen. And so I think, although it's brilliant to have that deal, it also kind of represented something bigger, which is that, you know, that drive to keep going and that notion that actually even 4 books in, you can get something different. You know, you can get another deal, things can change, you can get another territory. You know, like you just mentioned, you can sometimes get TV with like a later book, and the point is to keep going. And I think there are so many people that don't keep going, and that's sad. And I understand why, but I think that I really want to emphasize the fact that these things will never happen if you don't keep trying. And so I felt quite proud that I had kept going with that. And obviously, thank you to my agent who had managed to do the deal. And she was so persistent as well. And I think that meant a lot to me because I didn't really believe that we would get it. Not because I didn't believe in her, but because I suppose I just didn't believe in myself enough. And I didn't think that the American market would want me. So I think the fact that she kept going and she kept on saying, you know, this is the one, this is the one.
Congratulations, isn't that exciting? And the fact that she believed in you even when you didn't believe in yourself, and I saw that you had dedicated the book to your agent, which is really special too.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, she's great. And she, you know, she signed me I think in 2014 or 2015, and I was quite young, I wasn't working in publishing, and I remember I sent her the book by email, and she replied maybe 2 days later saying, can she read the rest of it? And then we went out for a coffee a few weeks later, and she did quite a lot of editorial work on it on the first one before we actually went out with it. But I think she's just been a real support in terms of someone to talk to and someone to guide you through that process.
Amazing.
So yeah, she's been great, yeah.
She sounds like she's been a whole mentor to you, because the fact you wanted to write, you weren't in that industry, and then suddenly you've had 3 jobs in publishing, you've become someone that people look up to, you know, and probably try and nab in the corner at parties when they are on and say, what do I do with my book deal? And, you know, somebody that people want to know, you know, that's brilliant. So good things came for you in lockdown, which is good news for all our listeners, because there's not much good news out there, and persistence pays off, determination to never give up to all the killjoys out there, and there's no barriers, you know, to age or story or timing or genre. It has to be right, doesn't it? Dream come true. How fantastic. And you've had many translations of your other books, haven't you? You've sold over 150,000 copies and been translated into 9 languages. I mean, that's amazing.
Thank you. I mean, I think it's going to be 10 now. I got an email the other day about another territory, which was great. And I think foreign rights, again, is something that I just never thought would happen, because it just seemed like something that would happen for other people. And, you know, there's always authors that have sold more than that. And there'll be, you know, there's always someone that's above you, and there's always someone that's ahead of you. And I think it's difficult not to compare yourself. I think a lot of authors do compare themselves to people who are doing better or people who are doing worse, you know. But
gosh, I think somebody at your age that's got 4 books already and one in America, I think it's doing pretty well, my goodness.
I mean, I think it is something that I know that a lot of my authors experience, is just that kind of comparisonitis. And really the writing community and the publishing community are both really supportive ones, and I think it's about finding people who will support you and people that you can talk to about the ups and downs, because although it might sound like things are going well, you know, I think there's definitely been points that they haven't been, and there's still a lot more that I want to achieve. I certainly don't feel like a successful person, and I think that you know it's kind of an ongoing process, you know, for everyone to keep going and to keep setting your standards, and but also to enjoy it while it happens. Because I was thinking back to when I was younger, and, you know, I would have been really happy with what I have now, but you always want the next thing and the next thing, and I think that that's a very human condition. But you know, maybe this lockdown will you know, make us rethink that a bit and just be grateful for what we've got.
I think be happy and content with the right now. And that, I like that word you use, that comparisonitis. But I know you've mentioned, you know, in terms of adversity, and this podcast addresses adversity, and you'd mentioned that rejection in publishing is a battle, and that's obviously something that has been hard for you to cope with. But, you know, to look at actually the celebration of the right here and now of what you are doing, I think, is really important. But let's talk about some of the rejection that you said you faced when you first tried to get publishers, because I think that stayed with you, hasn't it, in some of that self-doubt or self-belief, even though you're doing so brilliantly. And a lot of writers will find that, and a lot of creative people generally have that, don't they? That, how did you cope with that? What were the highs and lows?
So I think, firstly, I think everyone does face it. I think there are actually very few writers that sell their book immediately and get the first agent they query, but you don't notice that, because if you read The Bookseller or something like that, you know, you just see all these huge six-figure deals and you think, oh my God, everyone's done it apart from me. And it's so not the case. You know, there's a kind of whole swathe of people out there who are not getting those deals and who, you know, they've taken a longer time. And I think most people have faced rejection, and I think you do have to develop quite a thick skin about it. And so in terms of highs and lows, I think, so I actually got an agent relatively quickly, although I did get quite a lot of agent rejections. I did end up signing with an agent after a couple of months, but then it took a long time to get a deal after that. And I remember, I can't remember when we first went on submission, but I remember it was Christmas Eve and my agent put together all the rejections that I had had. Like, not, I asked her to.
No.
So I wanted to see what the editors had actually said when they'd said no to The Dollhouse. And so I had this like sad little printout with all these rejections on. And most of them were quite nice. You know, they said they liked it, but they didn't love it, or there was something wrong with it, etc. And it was quite useful feedback at the time, but I was going home for Christmas, so I was going home on the train, and I had this just little sad piece of paper in my pocket that I kept on looking at, and you know, none of them were saying yes. And at that stage, it was quite hard. And I went home, and I was with my family, and I wanted to be able to bring them good news, and I so wanted to be able to say to my family that I had got a deal, and I just couldn't say it yet. And so instead, I had to read them all these little rejections. And so I remember it did feel really sad at the time. But, you know, then a few months later, I think it was in March, we did sell it. And that really did change everything. And I think you just have to be patient. And I do think that you build up more of a resilience. But then the other day, you know, I got some slightly negative news about the latest one. And I was really upset by it again, you know, and you think you've kind of got past it, and then something happens, and actually it does still feel painful, because it's your work. And I think the problem with writing is you put a lot of time into it, so it can take some people up to a year to write a book, some people take even longer, and even if it doesn't take that long to write it, the whole process takes a long time because of the various editing stages.
Yeah.
And so then it gets to the end and it not be what you want, or something to go wrong, it can feel really hard
and very crushing. You know, it's quite brutal, isn't it? Harsh when people say yes or no, but it can be just timing. And I think it's that having that, developing that thicker skin that we're all having to do in lockdown, of actually it's not personal, it's business, it's just not the right fit for that, so something better will come around the corner. And even sometimes, you know, we don't understand things as they happen, but when we look back we think, oh, that's why, because, you know, it didn't happen because there was that amazing American deal around the corner or whatever.
I think definitely it is just sometimes a case of luck, and I think that it's never personal. It's always business. And because I'm an editor as well now, and I have to reject people's stories every week, and it's not a nice part of the job. You know, I wish I could make everyone's dream come true, but I can't.
Honestly, no. So I think, how it feels.
Yeah, but every time, it's never anything to do with the author. And usually I have quite liked the book, I just haven't loved it to the extent that I can publish it, and there is that difference. But for authors, it can feel really soul-crushing to get that kind of email.
I suppose it's similar to the music industry, isn't it? Is this going to be a bestseller and make everyone money? And if it's not, it's not quite there. And very difficult. So you've said, you know, if you do want to give up, that's fine, give up for tonight, or for give yourself a break, but don't close the door on yourself. I liked the way you'd said that in your blog. So you also wanted to share challenges and setbacks in your childhood. And these adversity stories really help others, particularly at the moment when everyone is struggling with something. Sometimes, you know, our life hacks or things we've been through, or how you have, you know, bared your soul today, saying you've had self-doubt and self-belief, and people would look at your amazing success story and you're a novelist and an award bestseller. the fact you've still got self-doubt will make people think it's okay to feel like that. But we wanted to talk about some challenges and setbacks in your childhood, if that's okay, that you wanted to share with us, on what you went through and how you've learnt to help others in terms of what you went through. So do you want to talk about some trauma, really, that you went through when you were a young child, if that's okay?
Sure. I mean, I don't know whether I would say trauma, but no, I mean, I think like a lot of people, my parents were divorced when I was quite young, and my mum was quite ill at that time. So it was quite a sort of difficult time. But I think what the effect was, like I mentioned in my email, was that it made me quite an anxious person. And I think that's the biggest challenge that I face probably every day. I think in my adult life, I do get quite worried about things. And like I said, the pandemic has made that slightly worse. But I think it's really important to say that I think that there are ways to manage that. And I think it's really important for people to, and I think it is talked about a lot more now. You know, I think people talk about anxiety a huge amount more than they used to. But I think it took me quite a long time to kind of find those resources. And, you know, there's a couple of really good books that I've read, and there are kind of techniques that you can use to move past it. And I think that it's really important that I never wanted to be someone that was defined by feeling anxious. And I think that a lot of people aren't defined by it. I think people try and move past it, but it was important to me that I was still able to, you know, have a career and be able to do my writing and have a, you know, perfectly normal life. And I mean, not the moment because of coronavirus, but in general. But I think underneath there is always this really anxious child. I was extremely anxious as a child. And I think it probably does stem from having that kind of family sitting up in quite a dramatic way. And I know that people do go through worse and it's not unique, but I think when something happens when you're around that age as well, like I think when you're about 7, it can be quite formative. And so if you're becoming anxious at that stage and you kind of get into a pattern of thinking the same thoughts and going down the same routes in your mind, and it's only that in the last couple of years I've tried really hard to try and understand that a bit more and try and change the way I think about stuff. And it doesn't always work. You know, I do think I'm still, my partner says I always worry about everything and I overthink things, and everyone does. But I think you can find ways to manage it, I suppose. And I think it is important to talk about because a lot of people hide it. And I think I'm probably quite good at hiding it. But I think it's important to acknowledge it to other people. And like you say, like a lot of people do these days, so it's not really that radical. But I do find it helpful when other people say that they feel anxious, or, you know, they get really stressed, or they have panic attacks, anything like that. I think it's really useful for other people to acknowledge that they have those things. And also, you know, it doesn't have to be a life sentence. It doesn't mean you can't go out into the world and do things. And I try hard to take myself out of my comfort zone with stuff and not let anxiety actually stop me from doing things. And I do, you know, I used to have a friend who it did stop her from doing things. You know, she was very hyper anxious, and she actually, there were a lot of things that she just couldn't do because she was too stressed. And so I suppose I just hope never to get to that stage, even though I empathize with her. I think it's important to try and manage it and to not let it stop you living your life.
Very hard, very hard. And thank you for sharing that, because, you know, that was very young, 7, to go through a parent's divorce. And your mum, you mentioned she was ill, but she was ill with cancer, which is, a huge thing to have to deal with very young and unsupported and, with a single mother. And I think all of that anxiety that you have talked about is totally understandable in terms of that foundation. And for you to share that, particularly at the moment, you know, so many people have triggers or trauma that triggers another trauma. Or I heard on radio that most women are suffering from anxiety, depression or loneliness in lockdown at the moment. I'm sure it's probably the same for men, but this report was just on women. And I think, you know, your experience, certainly from what I am hearing, isn't defining you. You look at how far you've come and how successful you are and how proud your family must be of you. And that anxiety. I think facing the anxiety and that awareness is certainly the beginning. And anyone that's listening to this that is suffering from chronic anxiety or anxiety that they can't cope with, or those panic attacks, as you say, or really, really worried about something they can't within their control, then please seek help or talk to a doctor or someone, because there are people out there, aren't there, that can help you.
I think you're right. I think this pandemic has made people even more anxious. Oh, it's weird. There were some people who sort of said it made them less anxious because they felt like everyone was now anxious, but I didn't really feel that. I just felt worse. And I think definitely it's important to talk to people about it, and also to understand that it's normal. And actually, I think with the pandemic, it's so out of our control that you kind of have to take a step back from it, because, you know, in the first, well, actually for quite a long time, I was really like obsessing over the numbers of the pandemic and, you know, really like honing in on the detail. And actually, I just realized that I cannot control that stuff. So, you know, and it's all about control. I think a lot of anxiety is about having control over your life.
It's about control. And I think it's about comfort. And I think it's about feeling safe. And that's, you know, fundamentally, everyone has a different way of feeling safe and whatever that is. And I've experienced, you know, through lockdown, all of my friends have coped with it differently. And I think it depends on their coping skills. It depends on their life experiences. Depends on what they have been through as to what they can draw on and what they can't. And just to be kind to everyone and to say, we all cope with these things differently, and however you cope is fine. You know, whatever anyone can deal with, whether they want to go out or not go out, or stay in or hide, or retreat, or lean in or lean out, or reach out, it's all fine, isn't it? Because we're all human. And I think that the wonderful thing about lockdown is that we're all talking on a deeper level. We're all relaying, even to our neighbours, to strangers, to friends, to family, to loved ones, how we really feel, not just the surface. And I think that depth can only help us in the future and become closer and more honest. Now, I wanted to ask about your influences and your passions. So who influenced you?
Gosh, I don't feel like I am an influential woman, so it's very nice that you've asked me. But I think, you know, in terms of writing, a lot of people, I really love Maggie O'Farrell. Her new one, Hamnet, is amazing, but her whole backlist is amazing. And I read her debut novel after you'd gone, when it originally came out. And I remember just loving her writing style. I mean, she's a much better writer than I am, but I think she was quite inspiring to me at that age, because I so fell in love with her books. So I think I'm influenced by a lot of writers, people in the business at my company. Publishing is a very female business. I think there's a high ratio of women. And so a lot of our managing directors and exec publishers are female. And so I really look up to them. And I think I'm lucky to be able to see those women in those positions of power. I think that's really helpful, because I know there are some industries where you don't get that. You know, you might be a woman working in an industry that's very dominated by men, and that's quite I think I would find that quite challenging. So yeah, I definitely find them influential. And you know, my mum and my grandma are both really strong women. My grandma's 90, she just had her first vaccine. And I had a chat with her on the phone the other day, and she was saying, you know, she's just saying that she's quite happy, even though obviously it's been a really difficult year for people her age. She said, oh, you know, what have we got to complain about, really? And it was quite uplifting to talk to her. And my mum's been hugely inspiring. You know, she raised us all, and she's very creative. She taught us all to read. You know, she was always hundreds of books in the house. We didn't have a TV when I was growing up either, because she wanted us to read. So we did read more. And I think those things definitely help. I think it probably, you know, made me who I am. And it definitely gave me that love of books and literature, which is basically, you know, both strands of my career now.
Definitely has made you who you are. How fabulous. Your grandma sounds fabulous too. And in fact, you know, talking about it, working in that female dominated industry, and a lot of men listen to our podcast too, and they're interested and curious, you know, not only how we overcome adversity and our struggles, but why and how women are influential and being supportive of that too. So we're pleased to include them too. So what are your hobbies? What do you do when you're not writing? I know you've contributed some of your short stories to amazing charities, including Samaritans, I believe, and some domestic abuse charities. So good for you.
Yeah, that's with a group of writer friends. We've done a couple of anthologies. We're going to do another one around Halloween, I think, this year. So, yeah, I write a lot. I read a lot. I've started running a lot. I think during the lockdown, I found exercise really good for mental health, really good getting out of the house. And I've started doing weird things. Like I started doing this paint by numbers kit that my brother bought me, which is really good for lockdown because it really focuses your mind. And it also stops you playing on your phone, because I think I'm always looking on my phone at stuff and I'm always on social media and the news and all this negativity. And actually doing something like paint by numbers is so mindful. It's really absorbing. So I really recommend it. If you're feeling anxious, definitely do some paint by numbers. It's great fun.
Brilliant, actually, because I think you're right. Too much television, too much on your phone. It's very overstimulating, isn't it? And you can feel a bit too wired and a bit manic, that you do need that green space, go for a walk, do something mindful. So do you have a mantra for how you live your life?
I don't have a mantra exactly. I have something that my old manager used to say to me, which is done is better than perfect, which I always really like. I think especially in work situations when you're quite busy, it's really important. Obviously you want to do a good job, but I think being perfectionist can sometimes hold you back a little bit, and I think it's better to get a job done, and obviously give it your best shot. And I think the same with writing. You know, some people I think find it really hard to let go of their manuscripts and send them off to their agent or their editor because they want to tinker with it more, but actually you've got to accept that you've done it and that it will never be 100% perfect. So yeah, done is better than perfect.
Definitely good advice for writers. I'm a frustrated writer myself, and you know, to even get one down on a page would be amazing and perfect. I haven't got that far yet, so I think you should be incredibly proud to have got four down and to have all those accolades, you know, in all those countries, in all those languages, and now to enter into America just as lockdown opens. I think you should be jumping in the air, and I'm sure you will be when we open up. So hopefully that'll tie in with the April the 12th lift. So thank you so much, Phoebe, for your inspiration, for your tips on writing, for showing us the world of psychological crime thrillers. Wish you loads of success with your new book. It's been really lovely talking to you today. I really don't think you should have any self-doubt or anxiety about who you are. I think you're doing amazingly, and it's fabulous that your dream and reality came true, and you'll inspire so many others, particularly in lockdown. If that's achievable, that lifts us up with the good news story today. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. It's just such an honor to be invited.
The Influential Women's Podcast is co-founded and host-presented by exec producer Nikki Bannerman and audio produced by Safran Mirza. Please subscribe for free on all podcasting platforms to hear our real-life stories out every other Tuesday.